It's Wednesday, May 3rd, 2017, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me, as usual, are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, President Trump's 100th day has come and gone. We'll talk about everything that went down Saturday, from the Pennsylvania pep rally, the new campaign commercial, and the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Also, the New York Times doubles down on science reporting and then brings on a columnist who pens a piece denying climate change. It's got staffers in a tizzy and subscribers are dropping the paper. Still, executive editor Dean Baquet says this is all a good thing. We'll talk about why. And we'll take a look at an ad that's circling the interwebs that's being called the antidote to that totally tone-deaf Pepsi ad we talked about a few weeks ago. And there's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well. But we're going to start with more change at the top at Fox News Channel. After months of scandal, most of it based in sexual harassment and gender bias claims, co-president Bill Shine is out, replaced by Suzanne Scout. The Murdochs have long been talking about the need for a major culture change and that Scott's elevation might be the result of the pressure that they felt to make good on those statements. But internal reaction to her elevation hasn't been entirely positive. NPR's David Folkenflik quoted an ex-Fox staffer that said that Scott's a nightmare and that she is just as bad as the rest of them. Another said she was worse than Bill Shine, her predecessor, deflecting the concerns of women there. And Gabriel Sherman of New York Magazine pointed out that during the Roger Ailes era, Scott was in charge of enforcing the mini skirt dress code for women. This has left many inside asking how this move actually could signal a culture change.
Well, it's one of those situations at Fox is that, okay, you take somebody out, you put somebody in, the person you put in was a part of the culture that created the situation
to begin
with. The
previous inner circle that was behind it.
I mean, what I can't understand is that why Fox or the Murdochs mm-hmm. won't just bring somebody in from somewhere else and try to clean it up that way. And maybe it has a lot to do with loyalty or trying to make sure that, you know, that things are running as smoothly as possible. But that's not the case at Fox right now. I mean, their shows are ongoing, but you can see the turmoil in the back, and now it's just becoming everything is a sideshow when you start looking at the management.
It seems to me like there's an attempt to make a culture change, and maybe that attempt is being tempered a little bit by business realities, like not too much all at once, but we already have had talent that have left. We've had management that's left. I don't know if Suzanne Scott is going to be a long-term solution there, but obviously the Murdoch brothers, who are taking over from the old man, are trying to look at the long view. Well, I don't know how successful they'll be, but they are trying to say, we've got bigger fish to fry, and if we're going to lose a talent, or if we're going to lose some management people, we're going to lose a little money in the short term, maybe that's okay, because we want to be making money in the long term.
And the deal with Sky TV is where the money is. And they have got to figure out a way to clean up what's going on at Fox, because if they don't, they're going to lose Sky again. This happened back when they lost News of the Weird and News of the World and the Whole,
maybe
which
News
is News
of
the Weird too. Yeah, but you know the whole scandal, you know, in involving that cost them the opportunity to purchase Sky about 10 years ago, and now here we are. Again, they have an opportunity for Sky, and they could lose it again because of what's happening.
So we
Fox.
Talk about the possibility of other talent leaving. At the top of that list that people are talking about, Sean Hannity, that there is a clause in his contract that would allow him an early exit given a management change of this proportion, of at this level. He's saying he's not going anywhere at this point.
I think it's an interesting question as to whether or not the Murdoch brothers, or for that matter, others in Fox News, would see Hannity's departure as a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, frankly, already it would give them an opportunity to completely reshape prime time. And Hannity is a particular issue for a lot of folks within the news division, because he's basically an unpaid advisor to President Trump at the same time that he's a commentator on the air. So it might be that whether or not Hannity wants to leave or is just threatening to leave or whatever, maybe the company would be better off if he did leave.
And I think you're right, because they can't do this rebuilding that they're talking about with Hannity still there. They're gonna have to move him one way or another, whether he leaves entirely or they move his show somewhere else, in order for them to be able to change the culture of what's going on and to change what they're doing. They're gonna have to move him. But the other question is, by doing that, are you going to hurt your base and eventually hurt the number of viewers that are watching
the
shows?
And in some ways, he is the anchor that's keeping the base intact. Right.
It would be easy, though, to go too far out on a limb and say, oh, terrible times are in store for Fox News Channel. They're still doing very well with viewers. They're still doing very well financially. There was some speculation with this whole business this week with Shine and Hannity of, oh, maybe a new conservative competitor can arise for Fox News. There are cable channels out there that do conservative news, but there's nobody that's going to compete in the near term with Fox News Channel. The investment that's required to start up that kind of a news operation.
And the environment is totally different now than it was when Fox News came into being.
Okay, well, we had been waiting for it since Inauguration Day, the 100th day of the Trump presidency. What would he accomplish in that time? What would pass? What wouldn't? Which nominees would be confirmed and which wouldn't? Well, we know now the answers to some of that, and we've had them reinforced in what can only be called a good old-fashioned campaign ad.
Donald Trump, sworn in as president 100 days ago. America has rarely seen such success. A respected Supreme Court justice, confirmed. Companies investing in American jobs again. America becoming more energy independent. Regulations that kill American jobs, eliminated. The biggest tax cut plan in history. You wouldn't know it from watching the news. America is winning, and President Trump is making America great again.
I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
A little non-traditional to have a bona fide campaign ad 3 months into an administration, but everything about this administration has been non-traditional. Because Saturday night, the president skipped the White House Correspondents' Dinner and went to Pennsylvania to celebrate with supporters. I watched it Saturday night with my mom, and over again, she kept saying to me, he does know he's been elected, right? He knows this campaign's over.
But he's in campaign mode. His committee reorganized, I think they said, in January before he took office, and it was paid for by Donald J. Trump for President, Inc. So it was not just looking like a campaign commercial. It was a campaign commercial. And what is similar to regular campaign commercials is the fact that there's a lot of stuff there that's deceptive. Things that are partially true or things that might happen that haven't actually happened yet.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of for the first time I saw the ad, I looked and I went, well, wait a minute, what is this, you know, what is he doing? Is he campaigning for re-election now? I mean, and to me, it just seems like he wants to keep the campaign going because that energizes his base, especially in light of the fact that he has not really had very many legislative successes. As we move on, yes, he got his Supreme Court candidate in, but Obamacare is still alive and well.
And appears to not be going anywhere.
Appears not to be going anywhere. And the tax cut looks like it's going to have some problems going into the next session of Congress. And the fact that there was almost a government shutdown, and a lot of it revolved around his so-called wall that did not get funded.
And now he's saying he'd like to see a shutdown in September. Maybe that'd be good for government. So, you know, the funny thing is for me, I was ready to really blast the media for once again focusing on 100 days. What, 100 days doesn't mean anything, truthfully. I mean, so there's some historical precedent, I suppose. But the president came in and with one hand said 100 days doesn't mean anything. Then he rolls out all of his surrogates in a campaign ad, so...
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. There you go.
Well, so that 58-minute speech that he did make Saturday night, the first 10 minutes of it was entirely a rant on fake news, the way that he doesn't get the credit for the good things he's done. We know that what he was saying isn't true, but do the people that were in that arena in Pennsylvania know it?
They don't care because, okay. I mean, they are there to support Donald Trump. And they believe that he could do a lot more than what he's been able to do, except he's getting stymied by either congressmen who won't do his bidding or the media that continues to attack him. So they're all still in sort of campaign mode here, and you could see it in the crowd.
I will say, though, if you want to talk about the pure optics of, say, the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which we're going to talk about, and this rally, here the president is in sort of semi-rural Pennsylvania. Right. He's at like a farm show, and then he's touring a factory with real people. compare that side by side with journalists in their black ties and their fancy dresses. Yes. And even though there weren't celebrities around, there's a pretty big contrast image-wise.
Or at least fewer of them.
Yeah.
While they were all in that arena, we have been talking about in Washington, the journalists that were going to meet with the politicians and a few celebrities sitting down for the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner.
We gotta address the elephant that's not in the room. The leader of our country is not here. And that's because he lives in Moscow. It is a very long flight. It'd be hard for Vlad to make it. Vlad can't just make it on a Saturday. It's a Saturday. As for the other guy, I think he's in Pennsylvania because he can't take a joke. You know Donald Trump doesn't drink, right? Does not touch alcohol, which is oddly respectable. But think about that. That means every statement, every interview, every tweet, completely sober.
So I will admit, by the time that he had taken the stage and that a lot of this had started, it was well past my bedtime. We have long since established I don't make it up much past 9, 9:30. I stayed up long enough to see our 10 students from the Missouri School of Journalism who were honored for the scholarships that they had won. At that point, though, I was out. Everything else I know about this evening, I got from what I read online. Your take on it?
I watched most of it.
Yeah.
Including the part with the scholarships. It was a totally different vibe. I mean, you had the head of the White House Correspondents Association saying we're not fake news. You had the scholarships being focused on for the first time in a long time. You had Woodward and Bernstein, you know, really giving a clinic on the importance of journalism, which was good for the however many people were watching this thing. And then you had Hasan Minhaj, who I thought was, you know, poor guy. I mean, they were searching around for any comedian who would do this. And he's one of the correspondents on The Daily Show, not the first person you're going to find. But he came in and did a pretty good job. There was some sense that he was, quote, told not to heckle the president in absentia, although the White House Correspondents Association said they didn't really say that. He did, of course, heckle him quite a bit. But even at the end, he got serious and said, you know, only in America could an Indian-American Muslim be able to come on a stage like this and attack the president of the United States. So it was a pretty sober affair.
No, I think it was a sober affair. I mean, you mentioned Woodward and Bernstein and the impassioned, you know, plea that they basically put out there for journalists to continue to do the work that they're doing and basically not get caught in the shiny bubble. Mm-hmm.
Shiny things.
And the fact that there needs to be, and we talk about this on the show all the time, there needs to be context and nuance in what you're doing and not just the sort of attack, because when you do that, that people see the attack and they don't see what's actually going on and what's being done and what's not being done on their behalf by the president
Congress. And it's interesting, and I'm kind of popping this on you guys unprepared, so forgive me for doing this, but we talk about Hasan Minhaj, but in the last 24, 48 hours, we've seen other comedians, too, who are using their platform very seriously. And Jimmy Kimmel in the video and his monologue mm-hmm. that has come up with his son and his son's health. That's not necessarily picking on the president in absentia. It's making real people's situation real to real people who may not otherwise have a connection or an understanding.
And I think it's powerful because that kind of reaction mm-hmm. from someone who has that kind of a stage will get people to think about, wait a minute, there could be some real consequences here to policy and actions that are taking place in Washington that I don't see right now, mm-hmm. but I can see at some point down the road.
Comedians can do it. If we can do it in television commercials, it's great to see this sort of discussion about serious issues and have it be more than just talking heads yelling at each other. So, you know, I would like to have seen the president show up there for this, and there are lots of ways in which the situation is less than ideal, but if we're generating these kinds of conversations, good.
Well, yeah. We said it a few weeks ago, changing libel laws in this country is going to be difficult, beyond difficult. Still, it sounds like the Trump administration isn't quite ready to give up on it yet. Reince Priebus said so this week on This Week. Take a listen to this exchange with Jonathan Carl.
I want to ask you about two things the president has said on related issues. First of all, there was what he said about opening up the libel laws, tweeting, "The failing New York Times has disgraced the media world, gotten me wrong for two solid years, change the libel laws." That would require, as I understand it, a constitutional amendment. Is he really going to pursue that? Is that something he wants to pursue?
I think it's something that we've looked at, and how that gets executed or whether that goes anywhere is a different story. But when you have articles out there that have no basis or fact, and we're sitting here on 24/7 cable companies writing stories about constant contacts with Russia and all these other matters.
Do you think the president should be able to sue the New York Times for stories he doesn't like?
I think that newspapers and news agencies need to be more responsible with how they report the news. I am so tired.
I don't think anybody would disagree with that. It's about whether or not the president should have a right to sue them.
And I already answered the question. I said this is something that is being looked at, but it's something that, as far as how it gets executed, where we go with it, that's another issue.
So this was about 10 hours or so after the White House Correspondents' Dinner, maybe 12 after that Pennsylvania rally. Is this a legit attempt at change, or is this another veiled threat, another way of poking at the media on the heels of that boycotted dinner?
Shiny bubble. This is what this is. I mean, it's let's distract and not talk about this, as opposed to talk about healthcare, to talk about tax cuts, to talk about climate change, all of those things. Those are the important things, but they want you to talk about something that's not going to happen. This is dead letter law that the president of the United States is a public figure, probably the most important public figure, and the media has the right and responsibility to report on what he does and to critique what he does while he's in office, and even when he's out of office.
100% correct. Except I will say one thing, though. Jonathan Carl asked the question, you know, and sometimes I think the media ought to just back off making ourselves the story, and we should try to focus on it. Did you hear what he said in the middle of all that stuff? He said, how that gets executed or whether that goes anywhere is a different story. They know it's a fantasy of the president's. They know it's a talking point. He basically admitted it. Let's leave this line of questioning and get on to more important stuff.
Right.
Okay, so we'll do that too. The New York Times newest columnist, Brett Stevens, he made his debut Friday with a column that defended climate change skeptics. And that didn't sit so well in the newsroom or with subscribers, 6% of which have been said to have dropped the paper since the weekend. Now, correlation doesn't necessarily mean causation. What was it about this column that got people so riled up?
Well, so first of all, he was a very well-known Wall Street Journal columnist who has taken on climate change and taken on scientists for a long, long time. And a lot of other liberal causes he's taken on as an editorial writer. So he's brand new, and his first column is basically saying, if you believe the critics, that he's once again, you know, a big climate denier. What the column really said, because I read it, I want to be really clear
about
this.
It's on our links blog, as can anybody.
It is, and he's saying basically, okay, look, there's climate science, climate change is real. The science is real. Humans have led to it. The question is whether or not we interpret data that isn't easily interpreted and we put our own political spin on it. You can agree or disagree with him, but I thought it was an interesting column and that it provoked a lot of conversation, which is something the New York Times has tried to do in the last little bit across the partisan
divide. Okay, so let's talk about that. The paper's executive editor, Dean Baquet, was on CNN's Reliable Sources Sunday morning, and Brian Stelter asked him about this. Baquet was quick to remind viewers of the separation between the newsroom and the opinion section, but supported the hire. Take a listen.
Brett, even though he doesn't work for me, is a fine writer who is surfacing important issues, and I think our job as journalists is to surface those issues. From my end, I have 10 people devoted to climate change. We've done the most aggressive work on climate change there is. We've traveled all over the world.
But you don't think he undercuts your own reporters?
I don't at all. First off, he lives on the other side of the house, but secondly, don't we want to surface all ideas? Don't we want, have we gotten to the point as a country when someone has a well-written, cogent position that people disagree with, they want to ball up the paper and throw it away? I think that's a mistake. I think we should hear what Brett has to say.
Okay, so Ernest, I'm watching you shake your head in agreement as you're hearing something.
No, I agree. I agree with what Mike said. I agree with what Dean said. I mean, he's absolutely right. I mean, this is sort of the classic way in which newspapers work, where you're going to have people on the opinion page that may not necessarily, that journalists within the news organization on the news side may disagree with, and that's the way it's worked. So, I mean, I agree with Mike. I read the column. I read it twice. I think that he is presenting a position where he's saying, look, the evidence is there, but whether or not people choose to accept that evidence based on their political ideologies, that's up to them. I mean, that's basically what he was saying, and I don't see any problem with the New York Times allowing him to write that.
And this isn't a one-off for the Times. I mean,
no,
they really have a long tradition of this. Well, and they also started something new just a couple of weeks ago, which I also like. It's a section that they put up every day or every other day called Partisan Writing You Shouldn't Miss, where they're actually featuring intellectual discussions from the right, the left, and the center from other publications saying, maybe you should check out this writing. It might help to have a conversation with people you don't agree with.
But I think this is the New York Times answer to the critics who've claimed that they're liberal all the time, where they're basically saying, no, we're presenting positions from all spectrums.
Well, and when I said that the New York Times has a tradition of this, this is also the same newspaper that had William Safire as a columnist as well.
Right. I mean, they have 10 times as many liberal columnists in the New York Times as they do conservative. But all of them try to write intelligently, and at least we can have an argument in an intelligent fashion, and I appreciate the Times doing that.
Yeah. Okay, well, this next topic is one that I kind of found buried online, but it fascinates me because of how obvious it is when you really start to think about it. A new Pew Research Center study looked at what and how people in Flint, Michigan were searching for on Google going back to 2014 and found that it based about 2,700 different search terms associated with the water crisis in Flint, that residents there were searching for information about their water before the government or before the media had recognized that there was an issue with contamination, and really before any of the local or regional news media picked it up. There are some real lessons here in how we as journalists can look at Google Trends and its search data and sniff out local news.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things people who live in these situations, they know what's going on. I mean, we're talking about the water crisis here, but you could say the same thing about environmental crisis anywhere. You could talk about financial issues that are going on in particular cities and that sort of thing. And people are looking for information to sort of confirm what they already know, what someone has said to them about something that's going on in their communities.
It's fascinating to me because what would be really great, these researchers had the luxury of some time. Mm-hmm. They got special access to some Google data that most people don't get. What if we could do this in real time? Now, I know Amy knows better than most of us with social media. We can do listening in real time. But going in and looking at searches like this in a community and then being able to tease out trends and story ideas in real time would help journalists a lot, but it would also help people in the community. We had just as a sort of an aside, we had a student team in our competition recently that looked at the very same problem, looked at Flint, Michigan and the water crisis there, and said, what if other communities could be able to see what was going on in cities that are not their own, but maybe similar to theirs, and could tease out these kinds of trends and maybe find local stories that were important to them as well? There's a lot we could do with algorithms and a more sophisticated use of the internet to try to find these stories.
Someone asked me last week if I had seen the newest Heineken ad. I don't like beer, so I usually don't go looking for beer commercials. I'm not the target audience. But this one from Heineken posted to YouTube, it was different. Let's take a listen to just a part of it.
Feminism today is definitely an excuse for misandry, man-hating.
If somebody said to me that climate change is destroying the world, then I'd say that is total piffle.
So transgender, it is very odd. We're not set up to understand or see things like that.
I am a daughter, a wife. I am transgender.
I feel like the battle for feminism definitely isn't done. The fight is never going to be over, if I'm honest with you.
You now have a choice. You may go or you can stay and discuss your differences over a beer.
I'm only joking.
You're happy for a second, Ed.
Well, I'm having a drink.
I'm having a drink.
Yeah.
I want to discuss.
Beer.
Yeah, beer and discuss.
Cheers.
At the end of the day, mate,
about reaching out to people, yeah. And you know, even if you wanted to convince people about your point, the productive thing to do would be to sit down and have a beer.
Just engage.
So we only were listening to about the middle chunk of that. It started out with these folks all from different walks of life, different perspectives, different political backgrounds, different social backgrounds. They had to build the bar that they were sitting at and then eventually find out about their differences and decide if they were going to sit down and have a beer or go ahead and walk away. Where does this ad succeed where perhaps the Pepsi ad failed?
Well, I think, you know, and I saw this when the ad first came out. Somebody sent it to me because they know I teach a cross-cultural class and I'm interested in that. And they sent it to me in light of what Pepsi had done. And I would say this ad works. It works and it doesn't work. Okay. It works because you have empathy and you have conversation and an attempt to understand. That's where I think the ad works. Where it doesn't work is that the fact that it is staged, and that's not the way in which the real world works. And the fact that you are selling a beer. They're sitting down over a beer. But if you watch the entire ad, you don't really get to that point until somewhere toward the end. Mm-hmm. So I think it works in that regard, and it highlights the empathy part of it and the conversation part of it in a way that Pepsi did not. Pepsi wasn't authentic. I mean, you know, you don't have models walking out of shops into the middle of a protest and then have cops dressed like they work at the mall instead of on riot patrol. That's where Pepsi made a huge mistake there. And the whole way in which everyone engaged. The Heineken ad's not the best ad I've seen, but it's far better than what Pepsi did. And it's something that could be used in a classroom to basically talk about, you know, how to actually do this.
It's a better example. Pepsi example can still be used in the classroom, yes. But not necessarily
and will be,
as a
and will
sh-
be used right. in the classroom.
Right, that still will be, just not necessarily with the same holding it up.
Right.
I mean, the Pepsi ad was cynical from beginning to end. You know, you have a celebrity, you have people pretending, actors pretending to be real people.
It was unintentionally.
Everybody could see through that. Yeah. This Heineken ad, first of all, it was, as you say, it was a 4-minute and 30-second ad.
Yeah.
There was an opportunity to have a story. Yes, it was fake. It was set up in a certain extent, but these were real people with real opposing points of view doing real work and then talking about their differences over a beer. Okay. It's not a perfect commercial, but in some ways it seems to me it's like the New York Times saying, let's have you read some conservative writers, even though we're not a conservative publication. You're causing a conversation to occur that otherwise wouldn't occur, and we need a lot more of that.
Okay. Well, that music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics that we talked about on today's program on our links blog. That's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @views on KBIA. You can also catch us on YouTube, iTunes, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. These are all great ways to watch or listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. Tim Piltrick composed our original theme music, and Lauren Wortman is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.